Okay, this is not a session with Ion, and it's with Harry Whittier and Greg Skinner and myself, and it's being recorded on May 30th, copyright 2010, New Grandview Incorporated, all rights reserved, and we're starting at 3:01 p.m. Hawaii time, which is 10 p.m. in Nova Scotia, where Harry is.
Right.
So Harry, my opening statement was that in the novel,
oh yeah, Harry Whittier is a great professor at Dalhousie University that I used to sit on in his classes in the 70s and 80s. I even got one of them on tape, and Harry was the only teacher who could say the same thing every day.
And never get bored.
Never get bored, applying whatever book it was, or any movie, the same message was there, and then everyone, from the Bible to Shakespeare to Lawrence Durrell, Alexander Quartet. And I was just telling him about my talking with non-physical, that's everywhere, call it Ion, and that there was a character in the Alexandria Quartet that Harry used to teach in the 80s, in the 70s, and by Lawrence Durrell, there was a character based on Carlos Suarez, a friend of Jack Sarfati. So that was a particular reminder, because I never read the Alexander Quartet other than the passages you covered in class, which I
was
a student, so I didn't have to read anything, but I would just listen to whatever you're talking about. I was looking for the same message being repeated. I was monitoring how much the same message was repeated in one man's mouth.
How many characters could you be?
That's right. And so I learned a bit about the novel that way, and that's all fine and dandy. So, here we are. The main question for you, Harry, have you read Inherent Vice?
I haven't been able to find a copy of it yet, Bob, I regret to say.
Well, you could get a bookstore to order it, right?
Yeah, I will.
But you don't do that if you don't order.
No, not if I can avoid it.
Yeah, right. So, but I guess Pynchon is so off the mainstream markets in Nova Scotia, they wouldn't have it on there. You'd have to order it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I haven't been able to get it, but I'm on the trail, you know.
Okay, so what is you found Against the Day totally different from his earlier styles?
Yes.
Yeah, now, I'll tell you what, talking about Pynchon with Ion, I haven't talked to Pynchon because he isn't dead yet, but if you die, I will talk to you. If anybody transitions, I've talked to many people. As a matter of fact, through Ion, we talked to McLuhan a good amount, and I got Mary McLuhan to have a session with Ion, and she got to talk to Marshall, her father, and Corinne, her mother.
Oh, that's great.
She was so impressed that she's willing to put her name on a public, you know, an advertised session with McLuhan.
My God, that's right. Marvelous, Bob.
So I've talked to everybody, but Pynchon, what is interesting is that Ion told me that Gravity's Rainbow was based on a manuscript that Pynchon got when he was probably working at Boeing, Lockheed, those aircraft places out in Seattle.
Yeah, on the West Coast, yeah.
Right, in the late 50s, early 60s. And the guy gave him a manuscript because this guy was part of Nazi Germany, knew the history and what went on in Nazi culture that is referred to in Gravity's Rainbow, like the use of mediums and other wacky stuff and looking at extraterrestrial travel, all these little things are hinted at in Gravity's Rainbow. That all was based on stuff that the Germans and Nazis were looking into. And he gave this manuscript to Pynchon. Probably, I don't know why he picked Pynchon, but I can just see that he's a guy working in the aircraft industry, this German guy, and he'd be impressed with this young man's knowledge of physics and spiritualism and all the different things Pynchon was interested in.
Yeah.
And then say, hey, you're a good writer. You could spruce up this book a bit, So Gravity's Rainbow apparently is based on a manuscript given by this guy, giving these secrets, and when it came out in 73, this guy was murdered. The military people in the Pentagon who didn't want this stuff out, they knew he had this. So then they go on, and then Ion says, that's why you will notice, and I didn't know this, I would not have thought of this, but he said, that's why you'll notice that the later books are such a different style from Gravity's Rainbow. Because they're written more by Pynchon and not this other guy's stuff.
Yeah, right.
And that was
interesting, Bob, yeah.
Yeah, because in 1990 when Vineland came out, it's been 17 years since the booklet came out, and many people were hoping for another hit of the Gravity Rainbow style, and they were disappointed with it.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's a good book on its own terms, you know, if you get into it.
And but it's all tension.
Yeah, so Ion said there will be two books influenced by this manuscript. Gravity's Rainbow, and I didn't know, and I have not read Against the Day, but I know what it's about. It's about that period before Gravity's Rainbow, late 19th century, early 20th
century. Yeah, it is.
And it gets into science, and I can just tell by reading the summary of fiction style, because I read a lot of his books, I knew this was the period that Ion said was the precursor to what the Nazis got. You see, the reason Einstein was able to figure out his stuff is that he worked in the patent office in Basel, I think it was, or Zurich, and he would see these incredible things being patented. And his theory of whatever, special relativity, general relativity, and that kind of talk came in 1905, was due to his reading this whacked out stuff that was actually based on secret technology.
Gong.
Yes, gong.
Bingo.
Yeah, and I haven't read Again Today, but I bet you it gets into the science psychic overlay stuff, right?
Oh, it sure does. Yeah.
And so I said, I know Against the Day is about that period, so would that be the other book, the other thing that Kinchin did? And he said, yes. And you were telling me that Against the Day is very different.
Yeah, it is.
Well, this could be the reason.
Sure. Yeah, it clearly is the reason. Well, I mean, there are other possibilities, but this looks like the best one.
Very good, because you were you were intrigued. You told me a year ago you were intrigued by the change in style.
Yeah, yeah, it's really quite different. You wouldn't recognize it as being the same man as writing it as the earlier stuff, you know.
And it's different from Gravity's Rainbow, though it might be similar in complexity.
Yeah, well, in complexity, the complexity's there, all right, but it's an entirely different perspective on what complexity is.
Okay, well, I'm just going on what Ion said, that there were two of his books that were influenced by this German guy.
Yeah, well, maybe the second one is this.
Pigeon working with the same material. It's a mixture of the German and him, more so or different than Gravity's Rainbow was a mixture. But they're both coming from the same inspiration.
Yes, that's right. That'd be a good way of putting it.
Yeah,
because there's a good deal of involvement with the German scene in Seize the Day too.
Against the Day. It's the same background, because it's popular culture. There's a few books on how the Nazis were interested in the occult and all that, but Ion has laid out that they had 11 particular mediums that they used, and these people were forced to do it for the Nazis.
Jesus.
And only one, several of them were followed or killed as the Nazis went down.
Yeah.
And there was one main one named Rachel. Rachel came through, or the medium, the vehicle was Rachel. I can't remember. I've done so many hours with Ion, I can't remember everything that I've got, and I haven't reviewed it all. But it's a very interesting, detailed story. And they learned a lot about technologies. And that's the secret part of Project Paperclip, that who's Von Braun and these guys, they began to understand about parallel worlding, and other aspects of reality, and they put it into their physics, and it's embedded in there, at least those guys that know this stuff. And it came from the inspiration of the mediums they had in Nazi Germany.
Yeah, yes. Gee, that's fascinating.
Yeah, I always remember when reading Gravity's Rainbow, which I did in 1975 during the Canadian postal strike, we were getting our mail coming in. And it took 6 weeks. I remember sitting there reading it, you know, just near where you were teaching on Seymour Street. And I remember coming, because I had done mediums up to that point, like Cosmic Awareness and that, and I'm reading this part, and I said, wait, what is this part? I knew, this really stood out, because this was odd that a writer, a humanist, would be writing that kind of stuff in the military context. And I've always remembered that section, and then it became very significant talking to Ion about it.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, yeah. Gee, that's a real insight. I'm just trying to catch up with you.
I do that. I call you every year and ram the new vistas down your throat or eyes.
It's great.
As you reel about the room trying to see where we are.
Sit down on a park bench and read the newspaper, God, that's beautiful.
Okay, so we got Greg. Greg, you give us a direction or say something that you want to say.
Well, I want to say that Harry was also, he led the Whittier Wake reading group that lasted at least 2 years, I think.
Yeah, he was the only one doing it. You guys just
did. Yeah. Well, I guess I mentioned that the other day, that Bart and I took turns sleeping, but...
Yeah, the...
I'm the hidden alarm clock.
Right. McLuhan used to quote this joke, a professor is someone who talks in other people's sleep.
So the crocodile and Peter Pan, you remember?
Yeah. Peter Pan what?
Peter Pan and the crocodile in the water, you remember that?
The alarm clock.
The alarm clock was ticking in the alligator.
I don't remember that.
No, it's all right. Well, take a look at Peter Pan and you'll see it. It's just an attempt at a facetious reference.
It's inspired by Alice in Wonderland kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's right. It's good. It's worth taking a look at.
Okay, so are you talking or teaching your class to the senior citizens these months?
No, I'm not, Bob. I came down with a... I'm going through the same process right now, a bunch of tests. As if I hadn't written enough tests in my life, you know. But they're giving me a series of tests on heart difficulties, so I have to renege on the teaching this term anyway. I may pick it up next fall.
Well, Ion, the main thing I've learned, the new thing I've learned from Ion, which I've been talking to since March 2009, is that every death is a suicide. So if you're testing, you ignore that. It's up to you to decide to die if you believe Ion.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's worth paying attention to.
Yeah. What? You mean the test?
No.
Pay attention to the fact that every death's a suicide.
Yeah. It is, in a sense. I used to say, you've heard me say it. You know,
yes, you have.
And a birth certificate is like a death certificate with it turned inside out. So, you know, you want to find out where you are, so look at the back of your birth certificate.
That's right.
You'll find the devil's signature there.
Yeah.
Bob?
Yeah.
Well, Harry mentioned the other day that a germ of his work came from the Book of Genesis and Homer's work.
Excellent. Now, Ion's done a lot on that. This, I think you'll like this, Harry. He says that people read the Bible backwards. It should be, or was intended to be presented this way. You read Revelations first, and you work towards the Garden of Eden.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, that sounds neat.
Yeah, I've never been said before. I've ever heard. It's meant to be, you get your revelation, then you go through all this readjustment to your revelation, and you should, if you get it right, you end up in the Garden of Eden.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Good. We got a professor. I'll tell Ion. Hey, a professor, graduate of English, says, that's right.
I never admit it to anybody but you, Bob. You're too smart to listen.
Right, Ion's done a lot on the importance of Homer.
Yes.
It's always from what I call bringing in the astral body knowledge. It's the astral, non-physical dimension. It's the astral body or astral realms version of our history. It's what it sees.
Yes, that's right.
And a lot of Homer, there was the Oracle of Delphi in Ionia. And that was huge for, you know, a long time. All the kings would come there. And Ion said that they'd have three maidens there. And they would get stoned on the vapors from whatever came out. I don't know if it was volcano stuff. Whatever the vapors that came out of the earth. They'd get stoned on that and start channeling. Or just... gibberish would come out, and the priest would translate what the girls would do. And I think they got killed after a while or something, you know, something.
Yes, there's a one.
But they would do this. The priest would translate it. But Ion said they were always translating it so the king who came for the advice got what he wanted to hear, you know.
Like Oedipus.
Yeah, but it was a major form of communication. Yeah, you said like
Oedipus,
right. Oedipus, form of communication of, it was their medium of the day. That's what people believed. They believed in something coming through these women. and spouting stuff, and it would be translated by the priest, and that was the news of the day and how you gauged your stuff. And that was a big influence, and then Homer came and started writing it down, which changed the whole dynamic.
Yeah, that's right. That's the way it can be seen, yes.
Yeah, but the... okay, so I don't know. What do you want to say, something great about Homer or the Bible or something else?
No.
I just wanted to point out that that was a strong spot for Harry there to create his work.
Yeah, you were translating the Bible.
I
remember
right.
what
I was reading
said.
It backwards.
Yeah, and that's exactly what Ion says.
Yeah.
Ion's definition of God is you. Ion says non-physical, which it is, and we all go to when we transition.
Right.
It does not create. Only you in the physical can create.
That's right.
Therefore, you're the God. And when you read the Bible, it's totally correct what you read in there.
Yeah.
If you understand God is you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And that's what you're
saying. In other words, we're suffering from a sense of mistaken identity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because Ion says, yeah, they look at us and we got everything upside down. Everything's backwards.
Yeah.
Reversed.
The great question about being reversed upside down or as it comes from, it's still having difficulty trying to find out how the finger that comes on your retina gets turned right side up.
Right.
Nobody knows what really happens.
You know, Harry, I never heard you say that. You may have in the classes, but the person I first heard that puzzle from was McLuhan. He talked about that all the time. Why are we
reading
the world upside down? And I remember now, you have that in your autobiography, you talk about that, right?
Yeah, just briefly, yeah.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. That's a key puzzle, and it does show you that we take in the sensory data and we flip it. We internalize it and make it our own.
Yes, that's right.
What else would you say about that? Go on about that phenomenon a bit.
I can't get any farther with it just to state that that's the case. You know, it seems to be the case, you know. I really, and I've done a lot of thinking about that on and off, you know. And the closest I can get to it is there's an article in a psychology journal that came out in 1898. A guy did an upside down view of the university he was in, the world he was in, by using a set of eyepieces that turned everything upside down and inside out and everything else. Fascinating thing. But even he didn't come up with an answer to how he did it. You know, it was just a physical phenomenon that he indulged himself in. That's very interesting.
He was the first guy to point it out?
As far as I know, and you know, I haven't done a lot of research on this, but as far as I know, I've never seen it anywhere else. I didn't even know McLuhan had mentioned this.
Oh, he makes it a core. He would take that, and he would say, he says, our inner faculties are connected to the outer world and are the same. Otherwise, we couldn't see the outer world.
Yeah.
So he would say there is a connection proof that we can take in outer world objects, so they must be part of us, or they must be connected to ourselves. And then he says, the interesting thing is that we turn it upside down, though.
Yes. And you say, why? What's the motive behind turning it upside down? And there is no motive.
Other than that's a metaphor for the fact that, as Ion says, the young kids today, they're being born and they're saying, you tell us this is the way it is, but we're not going to have it. We're not having it your way anymore. There's no uniform way. It's that willfulness of the individual cognitive process asserting its own dominion.
Yes.
God, or sub-God, you give me a world, I'll fuck with it. I'll turn it upside down. With that.
What are you going to do now? the answer to that, in case you need it, is a rollover, you know. I don't have an answer to that why on that reverse version of things, other than the fact that our medium of seeing is the eye, of course, and the lens and so on and forth, you know, with mirror and so on. And if that's our means of seeing, then that's what we're what we were indulging ourselves in and seeing that way, because that's the only way we can see.
That's right. Now, McLuhan take the word see. He says, okay, we flip things up. He says, that's an illustration that the individual makes their own world. So the basic aspect of cognition in all society is making. But then he said, literacy made us get exaggerated about the visual plane and then homogenize it and think that it's been... We get passive in relation to it and don't notice the active process of our brain flipping things. That shows our mind makes sense rather than matches with sense.
That's the creative part. That makes us God, you see.
Yeah.
And that's the answer.
Yeah, and so he extended that into visual space, literate conditions. We would be shocked by the fact we could flip it because we visually think that we're not connected to the world almost and we just receive it passively. But for primitive people and post-modern people, most people today are on drugs and do it for recreation, that's because we recognize the making and flipping aspect of our brains, and we're not under the literate hypnosis where we think we have to be passive containers of the world that is given to us. We flip it. We interact with it. We participate in it.
And in the attempt to cut ourselves off from it.
Right, because only during visual space society, literate society, would you even notice and fit the anomaly of flipping into your concept of what is. It's not important to primitive people. That's not a conflict that they make the world. They kind of instantly know they do.
Yeah, that's right. There's no conflict involved at all. Unless you regard changing things as, or apparently changing things as being a conflict, it can be seen that way.
Or a startling, because this guy is amazed. You know, the 1898 guy, he's amazed, but that's because he got a framework to think it is anomaly. It is not anomaly for primitive people to...
No, but what he comes up with at the end of the article, I don't have his name or the article or anything else right here, Bob.
Yeah.
But he comes out of it. He does this for a week, and so he's completely adjusted. And the normal world for him is the world will be upside down for us.
Right. Yeah.
He comes to an absolute adjustment to the reversed world. Then he says, "Well, I got to get back again." So he starts back again, and he takes off the lenses that he's wearing and the rest of it, and goes through the same experience that he did to get there, to get down off it. You see. And so what emerges from the article, really, and he doesn't say this, but it's manifest in the way he's written it, is that the two states are identical. So that the desire to get away from it is the desire to make them something other than identical. Because we don't like to think that there's another world that's just like ours, that's the reverse of the one we're living in. We don't like this.
We want
to know the fixed world
if we think we're going somewhere else. If we think we're going somewhere different, and you can't do that. It isn't.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, sorry, you're not allowed to go to Vancouver. You're already there. Yeah, that's right. Or Maui, in your case.
You go to the customs. You go, hey, I got an airplane ticket to go to Maui. She says, well, there's no such means to get there. You're already there. Yeah. The customs guy said, you.
you're the victim of a terrible fraud.
No, this brings up, I hadn't thought of it before, maybe I did, but I forgot I thought about it before. Ion says that we can take our being back, that's our physical body, and go to parallel worlds. It's not in your mind, you actually can go to other worlds.
Yes.
And Ion shows us how to do it, and you have this legend, series of symbols, and you have to sort of know those symbols because it's not hard to go to a parallel world. The hard thing is to get back.
You've got to have these
symbols to figure out how to get back, or you end up with this girl in Yale last year who was just stuck in a wall, died in a wall. No one knows how she got there. But here's the thing. The legend, what you know, what you learn from it, is the legend will flip upside down when you get into the other world.
Yeah, sure.
And then
you
know that to figure out how to get back, that your symbolism you're using has flipped, is turned upside down.
Yeah, I follow you. Yeah.
So the very thing that our eye does, according to science, we do in our physicality when we go to another world.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you're just an eye walking around. I've often tried to sell that one unsuccessfully.
When you get people using their ears and Walkmans all the time, they're not going to go for the idea they're an eye.
No, that's right.
You said you were an ear walking around. Oh, yeah, I agree with that.
You know, the world with the one-eyed man is king.
That was McClellan liked that one.
Yeah.
Only among the blind, the one-eyed guy is king.
Yeah, that's right. It's a beautiful comment.
So following this flipping thing. I think I had another thought there. The parallel. Oh yeah, McLuhan said that metaphor is looking at one thing through another. Even in the process of interacting with another human being, you don't know yourself. Because you only know yourself by how the face you're talking to is reacting to you.
That's how
you know yourself. So the very process of interacting with another is the essence of metaphor. Because metaphor is looking at one thing through another means.
Right.
And so there's a flip in that. There is an alteration. When I learn myself from what I see in your face as you react to me, that's actually a flipping of what I think is going on, but I have to go by what you flipped on me.
That's right. That's nice.
Yeah, that's good. So, Greg, what were you going to say for 5 minutes?
Well, I was trying to think of a ground for everything you were saying about the flipping the eye and the parallel universes and everything. And I remember, I think Harry once said that the world was everything was a dream, but it was because it was all we had. It was real.
That makes me think it's a dream. It's not a dream if you recognize there's an other that's translating the dream for you. So that would be my thing. So back to what you said, it's a dream, and it's all we have.
So it's real.
But maybe, you could take that many different semantic levels. Because we do not believe that other people are us, even though it is the fact that you don't know yourself unless you're interacting with someone else to see the mirror reflected back to you, to the degree that you can't accept that, then if you try to entertain it, you call it a dream. See, a dream implies that you've got another thing inside you that you can't control.
Mm-hmm.
That's making your brain experience something, right?
Sure enough. Yeah.
So the very metaphoric process, the process of metaphor, translating one thing into another, and it's based on the word for bridge, to carry across, that is the dream thing I was just talking about.
Yeah. And that's all we got.
All right,
that's great.
Hang on to it.
Yeah.
One way or another.
Ion has a couple aphorisms. It's never... It's more than enough, but it's all you've got.
I go with that.
Yeah. So, and you never... Another variation is it's always... You always get it done, but it's... No. It's always enough, but you never get it done. And you can't fail. You can never fail, and you never get it done.
He says it's like laundry.
Do you ever finish your laundry? Ion says, no.
There'll be some more next week.
And finding his weight ends with a laundromat image, you know, with many metaphors coming out of it.
He's looking at
some kind of turning over washing machine. That's cognition.
We
watch the world and alter it. When you this flipping thing, what goes in is not the same as what comes out. He says, you know, eat vegetables, goes in green, comes out brown.
Yeah, that's right.
And that simple process is the metaphor of what we're talking about here, how we flip things.
Yeah, and that flip involves, if you carry it in one direction, that flip involves the destruction of one form of it until the other is ready to come out.
That's the thing. This very point that you just said, and goes back to that article 120 years ago, that is what you taught every day. The puzzlement about that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, yeah. That's what I had in mind, more or less.
Yeah,
and you repeat that? Say that again?
He said that's what he had in mind. That was
annoying. I got that
light.
But what? Does something get destroyed when something's born, or is that what?
No, the very thing that he just said.
Yeah.
How did you say? You said something. I'm referring. First of all, you got the scientific experiment on the eye that he was talking about flipping. Okay.
The
upside down thing.
Yeah.
Then you said, what you just said 2 minutes ago was something about how we process the world and do something. And I, whatever you said, you hear it on the tape. I'm saying that point, Greg, is what Harry said every class, and he proposed the wonderment or puzzlement about it.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. And the flipping itself was, I went from the metaphor of the flip to saying that one way of reading that flip is to say it's a destruction rather than creation. Because creation is destruction in disguise.
That's right. And you wouldn't say it's either, and that's what the Hindu mythology, you know, they have the gods are creators and destroyers at the same time.
Yes, that's right.
It's an iconic...
Shiva,
Yeah, it's an iconic icon, metaphor of the actual process of cognition, which is what McLuhan said Joyce realized. In Finney's Wake, he realized that the cognitive process of mutation that we're talking about are the meanings of the ancient rituals of tribal people, or any of the stuff we see in his day in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
It was externalized in our language and art forms, was the very thing of this dramatic, what he called drama of cognition. It's a drama that we alter what comes in and turn into ourselves, and then we look at someone else to find out who we are, and they're altering what we've altered.
Yes. Yeah, it's a chain alteration.
A chain of cognition. You know that great line on page 18 of Finney's Wake, Greg? You know, can't remember, it's a whole section. Page 18, McLuhan quotes it a lot.
Yeah.
I used to be able to say it. I haven't thought, with Ion, I've forgotten everything that I knew because I got all this new stuff to process, so I'm good at Ion, but I'm not too good at what I used to know.
Things like that. Enough is too much.
Remember, it was, just get me, it goes, when something begets something.
Yeah.
Have you got Finney's Wake there, Greg? You got it.
I'm digging it up on the net here, if I can.
Page 18. Yeah. Well, just walk. Look, there's the computer. You can walk over to the bookshelf and grab the thing.
Yeah.
It's going to
spend
5 minutes trying to Google it.
I'm doing it. Hold on.
No, it's great. It's great that we have a Finney's Wake guy here who has the book, because this is a great quote.
Yeah, it is.
When you hear it. So you're close, Greg? Maybe he's not near the phone. Let's wait till he gets it.
Yeah.
He should be walking back to his bed, sitting on the side of his bed. I've been in that room.
it's the stoop of your ABCD blindness? Is that the one?
No, page 18, about halfway down.
Yeah, that's stoop if you are ABCD minded.
Abseed minded, yeah. Keep going.
Abseed minded. We and thou. In the ignorance, that's the one I know.
In the ignorance, let's do that.
In the ignorance, that implies impression that knits knowledge, defines the name form, that whets the wits, that convey contacts, that sweetens sensation, that drives desire, that adheres to attachment, that dogs death, bitches birth, that entails the spoons of Bob Dobbs.
Very good, Greg. I would have done that. I would have inserted my name. Greg, a fine graduate student.
I was not sure where that quote was because I was afraid I might forget it one day.
No, that's good. It's good. Now, let's read it. You heard it, Harry. It's really a quote. It's the process of cognition. This is a drama of cognition. So do it slowly, articulately, just each phase, Greg.
Okay.
Yeah.
In the ignorance.
Just hold the drawers. In the ignorance, that's the big one.
Yeah.
That implies impression.
That means receiving some stuff that you're going to flip. Okay.
Right. It implies that you're receiving it.
Yeah.
Just take a look at what you're doing.
In the ignorance of what you're doing, that's my impression. Next.
That knits knowledge,
in other words, relates to the percept of the impression is related to concepts or belief systems.
Right. That finds the name form.
Right. So that's what we're doing right now. We're trying to find the name form of this process we're talking about. And we're quoting the statement of the process here. The knits knowledge that finds the name form.
That wets the wits.
Now, that's the medium is a message. Once you have the name, the concept, that stimulates even more confusion and doublement and involvement in the process.
Right.
That wets the wits.
That convey contacts.
That what?
That convey contacts.
Now, that's C-O-N-T-A-C-T-S. That's like contacting with other people, or it can be a pun. It's also a process of how a guy gets published. You know, you went and come up, well, I got a new book called Work in Progress. Oh, that's interesting. Let's have a do lunch. And so, and you whet the publisher's appetite, and then conveys content. Oh, you should go over and meet Wyndham Lewis. You know, that sequence of people connecting is what's implied here, right? And it conveys context, but also implies that you have connected and starts to solidify what the name form suggests it's implied.
And you can think of the electrical thing where you contacted.
Yeah, you where to plug in.
Okay, that sweetened sensation.
So once you get something going, then you get really excited. So now you're inside the effect of the implied impression, and you begin to think it's profitable to engage it, right?
Yeah.
What did you say, Harry?
We'll publish your book.
Yeah, they publish your book. Yeah, sweeten all that money. Oh, we're giving $50,000 advance. Ooh, that's sweetened sensations.
Yeah.
That drives desire.
But then you don't get enough. You start saying, I want more money. Right. So then you start hankering for more that drives desire.
That adheres to attachment.
And all this happens because you're operating in the ignorance. You're not aware of the process that this paragraph is stating that you asked you to become aware of.
Yeah, that's right.
So what's the next thing?
Wouldn't you still be in the ignorance even if you're aware of the process?
Well, that's because as you think you understand it, we have this paragraph, we're using it to find the name form, but you have to remember that's an illusion or a duping too, right? But you can enjoy, as Harry would say, you can enjoy the infinity as well as knowing you can't touch the infinity. You do both.
That's right.
Okay. So what happens after sweet sensation?
After sweet sensation that drives desire, that adheres to attachment.
There it is. You're starting to get stuck in the success routine of a groove.
All right. Yeah. That dog's death.
Yeah, then you get pissed off that the idea is going to stop someday.
Yeah,
because it's so sweet. It's so sweet, this money. Who else is coming in? Shit, I ain't going to be here someday. Dog death.
That bitch's birth.
I shouldn't have even fucking wrote this book.
I'm finished forever.
And also metaphysically pissed off that you think that you began at some point. Shit, I wouldn't worry about death if I wasn't alive. I'd have to suicide myself to get out of this
dilemma. This gives rise to a problem.
So what's next, Greg?
That bitch's birth that entails the ensuance of existentiality.
Yeah, like, well, I guess I can't get out of this dilemma. I'll just drift along and hopefully something will happen.
Something's going to happen, man.
Yeah, it's interesting. He uses that term, you know, in the 20s or 30s, and the existentialism doesn't get popularized until, like, Heidegger or Sartre, you know, in the 30s or 40s, right?
That's right.
There must have been...
Jeez, yeah.
Existentiality could have been a particular concept that was peculiar to Joyce, or it might have been somewhere in philosophy. I'm not sure how... It wasn't a prominent term at that point that I know of.
No, it wasn't. But, of course, what existentialism is, if you have to use such a phrase, is all the way through all literature or artistic expression.
Yeah, it is... Dealing with being and non-being is another way of talking about it.
Yeah, that's right.
And he may have... It could be a valid new pun on existentiality that Joyce created there. And Sartre may not have been aware of it.
Yeah. Fair enough.
So that is... Now, McLuhan would cite that. He would cite that paragraph and says, this is the drama of cognition. He would say cognition is a cliched archetype process. Cliché is you have this experience, then you can become used to it, and then somehow it flips into immense significance. Like maybe when you recall an event, you know, 10 years later, wow, that was a great party or something. That sort of becomes archetype. So the turnover of cliché archetype and then back to new cliché and then new archetype, that is illustrated in the phrase, the meaning of the message, and that's illustrated by what we're just reading.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
That's good.
So, Greg, let me just see if there's another... Okay, so you have that. Now, if you go to page 614, This is the other great quote that Don Thiel, you know, the best student of McLuhan, the best Joycean, he would always put this quote in every book he wrote as an epilogue or prologue.
Is that 614, Bob?
Yeah, the beginning where it starts, our whole mole meal wheeling vehicle cyclometer. Just the middle of page 614.
Yeah, right at the bottom there.
Yeah, so before you begin that, this is Joyce describing a bigger scale, like sociology, so to speak. Whereas what we just heard was psychology, the individual cognitive process. Now you have the collective process, and what happens interacting with new technologies or new events, and the comings and goings of the public world, which I call the outer kingdom. There's your inner kingdom, then there's the outer kingdom, and then the resolution of the two is your middle kingdom. That's the ion model. But now so the inner kingdom is what we just described in a way, the interaction of you with reality.
And did you call the other one the corporate consciousness at one time?
Yeah, it's the corporate world, or the outer kingdom, that part that you don't have to engage with if you don't want to, but you can't ignore your inner kingdom too much.
Right.
Yeah.
So just before that starts, the word before it is forget.
Forget to remember, isn't that the whole thing?
No, it just says, forget to remember is one paragraph before that.
Yeah, read that. He goes, read that.
Okay, he says, forget, remember.
Forget to remember.
No, just
remember that.
Just forget to remember.
Yeah, that's right. Wait a minute, where am I?
That's right. Like Ion does it. He'll go, okay, we're gonna give it to you now. Now. Oh no, maybe that now, right now? No.
Yeah.
Now. Okay, here we go. Here, now. And he was trying to get the now when he would sort of start the launching pad of what he was gonna say and make fun of the fact he couldn't get the now.
That's right. There isn't any now.
That's right. There is no now.
It's already yesterday.
That's right. Oh, and that implies the future. But the present, that's the void of the present. And that, you know, this Eckhart Tolle is a new popularizer of get into the now, your eternal now. And he doesn't teach them that there is no now. That's the real wisdom.
Yeah, that's right.
You cannot, and that nebulous quicksilver, you touch mercury or quicksilver, just you press it and it splits, right? You can't, like, hold it. That's what you're trying to experience now. You can't hold it. But the more you understand that, then you get the now.
Yeah, I heard a quotation, I don't know who said it, but it's good, and that is that the past has no future.
Yeah, the past has no future?
It has no future.
And McLuhan used to say, the past ain't what it... No, nostalgia ain't what it used to be.
Yeah. Well, that's a humorous look at the same remark.
Yeah, the same thing. And then the other people say, there's nothing new under the sun. McLuhan says, there's nothing old under the sun.
Yeah, that's right.
And then another one, you know, Heraclitus, you can't step in the river, the same river.
That's Heraclitus,
McLuhan would say, not only can you can't step in the same river, you can't even step in it once.
That's right. So don't try.
Yeah.
We're going to try anyway, Bob.
Right. And that's when you're going to try, that's the first word of Finney's Wake, river run. You're in the river anyways.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You're in it anyway.
Okay, I think we got all the aphorisms there. He ends a book, Cultures of Business, with the sentence, there is no finish line.
That's right.
Last sentence of the book. Okay, so this is the collective, larger outer kingdom description of what we already heard in this page 614.
Yeah.
No, I mean, Greg, start, Greg.
Do you want me to read that?
Yeah.
Okay, he says, our whole mill wheeling Vigo cyclometer, a tetro dominational
gazebocroticon.
Gazebocroticon, bracket the Mamaluja, known to every schoolboy scandaler, be he Maddie, Marky, Lukey, or John Adonk, auto genetically pre-provided with a clever coupling smelting works, ex progressive process, bracket for the farmer, his son, and their homely codes, known as egg burst, egg blend, egg burial, and half can. Receives through a portal vein the Dialytically separated elements. Precedent decomposition for the very pet purpose of subsequent recombination, so that heroicisms, catastrophes, and eccentricities transmitted by the ancient legacy of the past, type by type, letter from letter, word as at word, with sentence of Sundance, since the days of Pluny and Columcillus, when Glacinta, Provence, and Margaret swayed over the all too ghoulish and illyrical and innumantic in our mother nation, all
mosaically.
Okay, assimilated and printer identified. I should have my glass, the other glasses on. Idiotically, in fact, the same old atomic structure of our Phineas the Old One, highly charged with electrons, is haphazard special. May there be for you.
So that homo, he's saying all that stuff, may it be there for you.
May be there for you. My cup, platter, and pot come piping hot. End the paper, and there's scribblings, scrawled in eggs.
Scribings. So, Greg,
now that it's hard to read this stuff, so let's go through it again. I think you might make it more fluid since you know it now. Just go through it again, sort of slowly, but just, it's really beautiful. It's dialectic.
Yeah.
It's dialectics and more than dialectics, and it's a tetrad. You go forward, that retrieves something from the past, which was gone before, and then it flips into something new, all written and predicted by the legacy of the typist.
Yeah.
So you want me to read that again?
And it's something reading it is like eating your morning breakfast. That's what you're saying, with your eggs. Okay, yeah, read again. Let's see, you know it now.
Our whole mole mill wheeling ecocyclometer, a tetra dump dump.
There's your tetrad domational.
Domational
gazebo. Croticon.
The model
is icon is in there. Gazebo. I-C-O-N. Icon.
Gazebo. Yeah, icon.
The Mamalooja, known to every schoolboy scandaler, be he Maddie, Marky, Lukey, or Jonadonk, autokinetically pre-provided with a clapper coupling smelting works, ex-progressive process for the farmer, his son, and their homely codes, known as egg burst, egg blend, egg burial, and hatch ken, proceeds through a portal vein to dialytically separated elements of precedent decomposition for the very pet purpose of subsequent recombination, so that the heroicisms, catastrophes, and eccentricities transmitted by the ancient legacy of the past, type by tope, letter from litter, word at word, with sentence of Sundance, since the days of Pluny and Columcillus, when Giacinta, Provence, and Margaret swayed over the all too ghoulish and illyrical and innumantic in our mother nation, all
animistomosaically
assimilated and pre-identified
paradoxically.
Yeah, in fact, the same old game bowl, Adamic.
In fact, the same old class as usual.
The old one. Highly charged with electrons. Off-patent effective shit. May there be for you, cock-a-loo-luminous. When cup, platter, and pot come piping hot, assures herself, pits hen to paper, and their scribing scrawled in eggs.
Yeah, and you can put that, he's saying this, the old one, all this stuff will come to you as sure as you will type stuff. And just think of people today, they're texting all the time on their tweetering and their little, iPhones and that. They are always typing and communicating, and that's what he's saying. As you do it, you'll... This is the big picture that you can eat while you're engaged in the ensuance of existentiality that you're tweeting about.
So it's gain of cognition on a corporate level?
Yeah, this is the corporate level. The good part there is Well, it's all good, but an interesting part of what I said, the sendence, S-E-N-D-E-N-C, of Sundance, right? Isn't it?
Yeah.
The sentence of Sundance, that's the grammar. You know, he was a translator of languages and taught speech. The sentence structure, that grammar, is applied to the rituals that tribes did as a metaphor for that cognitive process we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
The sentence of Sundance. You know, we think of Sundance rituals. That whole thing that you just read is the core of what McClellan says Joyce discovered, that the ancient rituals mime the drama of cognition.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you bring in the effect of writing that confuses that.
Is writing doing the same thing, miming the rituals?
It changes the perception of what the ritual was. As a matter of fact, it makes people think ancient rituals are obsolete and mythical and illusory. We invent new technologies to do that. And then that leads to a re-tribalization to the technologies we make in the 20th century, the electric technologies.
So we
go toward a re-tribalization of humans through a dogma that's caused by print, where we discount all that was done in the ancient past as myth and superstition. That's the process that's going on there.
Yeah.
That he's referring to.
Yeah, oh, that's great.
It is.
Yeah.
And then I don't know, the other, you got that quote, and you got the page 18, then you got 52. Page 52, which gets into the stuff that McLuhan could distort and make his version of Fitting His Wake, but he had that sentence there to prove it. On page 52, it says, television kills telephony and brothers boil. In Brothers Broil, the eyes demand their turn. Let them be seen.
Very good.
Yeah.
Yes. Let them be seen.
Yeah, and you do that by book. So he's saying that the electric age, television and radio, they're killing telephones. Television's killing telephones.
Right.
It's like the interactive on the personal level that a telephone has, where you can be in two places at the same time.
Right.
Electric telephone, one-on-one. That is made collective with the television, where everybody can see a live performance and interact with it at the same time, rather than just privately on the telephone.
Yeah.
So television kills telephony in Brothers Broil, the battling of different media structures and sensibilities thereof, that battling, that eye versus ear all the way through, the poet versus the painter, the politician, the emperor versus the leader, all these dynamics. Television kills telephony in Brothers Broil. The eyes demand the turn. In other words, he recognized we're going to an acoustic. That's, you know, everybody's ear and even tactile. The visuality, writing, literature becomes a faded medium. It doesn't control people or influence them as much. So when the eyes demand their turn, then Joyce says, okay, I will help the eyes and write this book that shows the whole process. And that's what he means when he says, let them be seen. Let the eye be seen through the agency of a book that lays this complex process down.
Yeah. Here's looking at you.
And look at that. Here's looking at you.
Yeah.
That is what we're talking about. You don't know yourself unless you talk to someone else.
That's right. You're all alone until you talk to someone else.
Yes, you're all alone when you're talking to someone else. And that's self-esteem.
Where are you when you're talking to somebody else?
Yeah.
Where are you?
Are you somewhere else?
It's not a problem unless another bunch of people come along and ask you what you're talking about and make an issue out of it.
Yeah.
Right. So we're making an issue out of being alone versus talking to somebody.
Say that again?
We're making an issue out of being alone as opposed to talking to somebody.
Both, it's...
Here's
Ion, I'm finding Harry is clarifying a lot of these things in a real simple way. This doubleness of consciousness, here's what Ion said. There's two of everything, so there's always two conversations going on about anything.
Very good.
Two conversations going on. So it's ear and eye, and so you're both alone and involved with someone else. Two conversations, and depending on the culture and that, they shift you to think one way or to think on the other side. But the listening person is in the middle, balancing and engaging both, aware of the duality of both, and yet it's also where there's not a problem.
Yeah, if you want an interesting parallel for that, Bob, take a look at Moby Dick and the description of that. I can't give you the chapter page number or anything, but At one point, he's describing a whale's anatomy. He talks about his eyes and ears. And he's doing exactly the same thing you've just been speaking of. It's fascinating.
Oh, I have to find that, because it's that kind of stuff that Wyndham Lewis and Joyce were reading that gave them, that they were picked up on that tradition or that stuff, that kind of writing, gave them ideas. And then they realized, living a bit later, and Melville and those guys, that they saw, oh, look at this, we got movies and television, what's that doing to us? You know, they just started seeing with a bigger scenario of communication going on.
That's right.
But the same dynamic of awareness of your senses.
Yeah, he talks about the problem that the whale has, this is the sperm whale he's describing, but he talks about the sperm whale's problem in looking out, seeing one thing out of one eye and the other, and another seeing out the other.
Right.
And there's only one whale there.
Yeah, the way we interpret insects, the way we try to figure out what they're doing, oh, the fly sees 50 fucking eyeballs or sees 50.
Yeah.
That's our own anthropomorphic projection. It's pretty interesting. We're trying to translate a process. Like, they don't know why or how a hummingbird flies. It doesn't, or a bumblebee. I mentioned this. They do not know. They cannot explain why the bumblebee flies. If you use your normal human mechanics, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that's right. You shouldn't be flying, if you say the bee is flying.
That's it. You're impossible, bee.
Where did you get that license?
You think we're going to take you and pay any attention to you, Mr. Bee? No, really. We don't care if you become extinct, because you're impossible. You're just an anomaly. It's impossible. Get out of here. Get out of here. You're hissy, Mr. B.
I just removed your sting.
So while you mentioned whale, I get to look at whales leaping out over this bay I see every day from December to March.
Yeah.
The humpback whale comes here. This is where they mate, right in this bay that I look at.
Oh, terrific.
Yeah, it's incredible. Like 3,000 or 4,000 of them come.
Okay. Whoa.
Oh, yeah, I can go out there. We go on boats, and they're fucking leaping right off, just off from you.
God,
they're
yeah.
huge, you know. They're huge. It's like a big penis coming out of the water, big black beep. And then splashes down, and you get the big splash on you. The sperm splash.
The sperm splash. There's nothing like it.
Nothing like it. Tastes great. So why, okay, you brought in Moby Dick. I like what Harry used to say. I first heard it from you, you know, back in the 70s.
Yeah.
Tribal people, they say there's no such thing as opposites, because they were united by their oppositeness, something like that.
Yes, yes. The oppositeness is the quality to which there is no opposite.
Right. And so
where are you? You know, there is no such thing as no oppositeness. That's the point that's being made.
Okay, and if the culture does not put much weight on where the eye shows you where you are, and you don't get implied in that impression as a big deal, then the issue of the whys and hows and when don't enter into your thinking.
That's right. That's right.
And that's why Ion said that the Tibetans didn't know any better, so they created a Shangri-La. The Mayans the Mayans evaporated into another dimension. The priest said, hey, we can go somewhere else. Nobody had any concepts to say, well, that can't be done. And that's why Mayan culture disappeared. They went into a black hole.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah.
The point is that there's all these cultures, Ion says, that have... They had none of the perceptual assumptions that you have.
Yes.
Therefore, they could do things that we would say would be impossible. But it's not for people. If you think it, it is. And the more you can think, and I guess a group of people thinking it, then it is. No matter what the thought is.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And then and then language comes in and wets the wits. See, language comes in and distorts the thought process.
Yeah.
And adds to it, and then sweetens it. You can look at that. You can see that whole paragraph, page 18, is the effect of a medium. Wets the wits, and sweetens sensation. That really is what McLuhan was called, the effects of a medium, collectively on people. It does that.
I don't remember the passage, so I don't know the wake that well, but it holds an echo for me in my head.
That paragraph we read.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Isn't thought made out of language?
Well, that's only if you think those concepts about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's not an issue for people who don't even know they're thinking. Like Ion said, the caveman did not even know it had feet.
Yeah, I've read that somewhere. Yeah.
It's just a nub of sensation, and you don't have any concepts solidifying any in other words, when they talked to somebody, they didn't record it, they didn't write it down and read it, it just came and went and was forgotten, maybe.
Yeah.
So there's no stopping at any point on a particular concrete symbol and then making your society revolve around that concrete symbol.
Yeah, in other words, it's before the conceptualization of everything.
That's right. They were getting the flight, the rush of images, I assume. They're getting some effect on the brain, maybe not any imaging at all, and just responding to cold and heat and bite you, or you step on something, or you taste something that's really sweet, or you bump into a bosom and suck on it, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So they didn't have thought, per se, until they started to conceptualize.
Well, here's McLuhan says, you know, the content of a medium is always a previous medium, so the content of books was speech. But what was the content of speech? Nonverbal mental gesture. That's a very good phrase. Mental means it's a bit of a mind sensation. Gesture is what you can see, and it's not verbal. It's an interplay. And that interplay, you can't say where thought leaves off and language begins.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they don't have an image that they agree on to say, this is the letter A, or this is this. Okay, now we have that. Now this leads to this letter. They don't agree. They don't. They're really living in the flipping of the eyeball. An extreme, you know. They don't even worry about it.
Great.
So if you, it's determined, it's based on how you imagine the word thought. You say thought, what is thought? You can't see thought. Or you think you can't see it. You might
try. it's the now that we can't get into.
Well, you close your eyes and you can see things in your eye screen with closed eyes, but what do you say about that? There's nothing to say. I'm looking at a million miles away, or am I just looking inside you? If you don't have a concept or an image of what you're looking at, then you can't begin to think about it.
Yeah.
It's just a river run of sensations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, McLuhan did a tetrad on, you know, speech, but he did one on a word, verbum, V-E-R-B-U-M, and it was basically grunting.
Yeah. Grunt,
And he did a tetrad on analyzing the dynamics of that. So you would have to analyze the effect of verbum before you got to verbalness or speech.
Yeah, that's
And it's really, he takes that quote from Descent into the Maelstrom by Edgar Allan Poe and puts it, or Quentin Fiore or Jerome Agel that did the mediumism massage with McLuhan. McLuhan didn't do that book, they just used his quotes, but they placed this quote from Descent into Maelstrom, because they knew McLuhan quoted that story all the time by Poe, and he says, I must have been, matter of fact, you got the medium as a message there? You should have it in there. Greg?
Yeah, I should have it here.
Yeah, if you can follow what I'm talking. He says, I must have been delirious, and he talks about what he contemplates. So it has a picture of McLuhan, a guy, a businessman looking like McLuhan surfing over a wave. But look at what he says. Have you got the book there, Greg?
No, I'm looking well.
Because it's a really, it's the very thing of contemplation of the process of your existence. It's something like, I must have been delirious, for I contemplated, you know, the whirling velocities of this little thing versus the other whirling velocities of that.
Yeah.
That would be the remorse of the caveman who actually fucked up and solidified his thought and made an image about it. And then he's talking about how his life went to hell, and he's talking to the other caveman, you know, I made my mistakes, I must have been delirious when I first started looking at the velocities of the whirlpool of sensation, you know?
What stage is it on, Mark?
Near the very end. And you'll see him, there's a picture with all these faces numbered, like a puzzle.
Yeah, I hardly know, sir. Just
right.
At present.
That's from Alice in Wonderland. So then there's a quote of McLuhan surfing, a picture. Just look right around there.
Right after that?
It's in that last 10 pages of the book.
Oh, okay, and we're looking for...
I must have been delirious, is the quote.
Okay. Yeah.
You just have to look for a picture near the end of McLuhan on a wave.
Oh, there he is. I must have been delirious, for I even... even sought amusement in speculating upon the relative velocities of their several descents toward the foam below. In his amusement, born of rational detachment of his own situation, Poe's mariner in the descent into the maelstrom staved off disaster by understanding the action of the whirlpool. His insight offers a possible stratagem for understanding our predicament, our electrically configured whirl.
W-H-I-R-L.
Yeah.
World. So, this is a good quote to come to, because he's talking about studying and saying there's a service to looking at this with the requisite involved detachment, the perceptive detachment. That process is what he was trying, Joyce was doing with page 18 and with page 614. So with that in mind, it's also, I'm saying, that the complaint of the guy who did that. I must have been delirious to attempt to get that.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So
yeah,
read it again with that in mind, Greg.
I must have been delirious, for I even sought amusement in speculating upon the relative velocities of the several descents toward the foam below.
Yeah, so McLuhan used to say in the 50s that Plato described the effect of the movie, the lighted cave. You're in the cave watching the movie in the dark movie theater.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas TV said offered the spume, S-P-U-M-E, of reality just coming out constantly in a live situation. So the flow of imagery and all the senses in TV was way different than the cave aspect of the Plato's cave aspect of the movie medium. Different experience. So contemplating about that, McLuhan felt was worthwhile, you know, in the 60s. But it's interesting, he quotes Poe saying it's delirious to do that.
Yeah, delirium.
Yeah, so he's saying, now this, he gives that quote, which is an ironic statement. And then he says, now this is a strategy we should develop to understand our present world. So this is a satirical statement by McLuhan.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. He's describing his own perception.
Yeah, yeah. He said, okay, this is what we need to know. This is what we teach the kids. And all the kids must realize that they're delirious contemplating the stuff we're telling them to look at.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's great.
Anybody want to say any more?
I thought I was going to spontaneously combust before we even started, but my body's still here. But.
Yeah, just read that part on page 614, the recombination of predator-identified decoupling components, dielectrically, you know, interacted, whatever it says. That's your anticipation of actually getting on the line with Harry and I.
On page 614, okay.
Where it says pre-identified dielectrically decomposed, that's what you're saying you're expressing.
Yeah.
You anticipated, you're saying you were excited before you even started the conversation.
Well, I think my wits were too my wits were too wetted, and then the contacts were electrical, and then everything went up.
And you forgot your existentiality.
Yeah. Drowned in my existentiality.
You didn't remember to forget.
Yeah,
that's right. And then we went. Then I had to tell him, here, go to your own library, find this page, and reorient yourself. I had to guide him to it. Oh, that was surveillance.
That's very good.
Great.
Oh, well, so what? Let me see what time it is. I have to organize my day so that I get to go to the beach.
It's 11:09 here.
Yeah, 10 after 4. So that's good. I'll get to the beach. I'll tell you an interesting thing for me, Harry, is that I'm interacting with Ion almost every day. It's a pretty interesting energy. Is that I only require 3.5 or 4 hours of sleep now every night.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah, so...
No, that's terrific.
Yeah, and, you know, if I had a 9-to-5 job or was a construction worker, I think I might need a little more sleep. But the way I live, I don't have to go anywhere. So I can have a natural, relaxed flow, right, in my day.
Yeah. Oh, that's great, Bob.
Yeah, so what I did is, there's a TV series called 24.
Right.
And I don't know if you got it up there, and it's 24 shows in a season, 24 episodes, which cover an action over 24 hours.
Oh, yeah.
It's like Bloomsday. It's like Bloomsday.
Yeah, I was thinking of Ulysses.
Yeah, so in Ulysses, he's documenting almost 12 hours, like 24 hours. So this show is a big drama every hour. So each week you see an hour, and 9 to 10, and next week it'd be 10 to 11.
You
know? Yeah. So I watched. It's been going. It's a big successful thing, award-winning thing, and it's in its 8th season this year. And just
it's finished this year, I think.
That's why when I heard it was finished, I decided to track the whole year. So I watched the climax up till I think it was last Monday night. It was Sunday, not last Monday, and. So it was so good because they showed quadrophenia. They showed four tensions going on in the screen at the same time. They often show the four different characters in their own little worlds having their drama. They try to figure out what they were doing.
Yes, terrific.
Yeah, and so you have this fourness going along. So so I went back to after it was over. I said, well, I'd like to see how this started. So I went back to the first season. Started right after 9-1-1, and the show was on Fox, I think. It is total propaganda of what the people thought was going on in the panic after 9-1-1. Uh-oh, the terrorists are going to blow up Manhattan any day now, you know? And
yes.
Those kind of scenarios are acted out every week on this show. And it's very hyper. It's totally... Nothing happened. 9-1-1 basically nothing happened after. But everybody lived it through what Bush said would happen. They lived it through the TV show. So it was a major high-tech, almost brainwashing operation.
Yeah.
They knew people would not get the panic, but watch this show, you get panicked. Okay, so I went back to the first show, and the first season. So that means I could watch it in 24 hours. So I started Friday afternoon, I think it was, started watching it, and it was so good. It's on Netflix. It has no commercials and goes from one episode to the next. You know, you just go right through all 24 of the first season.
Yeah.
And whereas if you watch it during the week, you have one exciting hour or tense hour, and then you got to wait a week for the next hour, right?
Yeah.
So I was flowing through so well that when I got to about 2 in the morning, going into Saturday morning, I was not tired at all. I said, fuck it, I'm not going to bed. I'll just keep going. So I went from, night, late afternoon Friday till 4:30 or so this morning.
Yeah.
So it was basically about 44 hours.
Good God.
Straight watching. Great. And in between, I had to stop off every now and then, you know, to fuck Carol or do something civil, you know. And we had two clients with Ion, two readings, so I had to do those. So in between that, you know, I was doing this, and it was so great. I remember Dylan saying in the 70s and 80s that India, Bollywood, has seven-hour movies. I've never seen one, but apparently their movies are really long.
Yeah.
So, and he said he wished Hollywood movies would be like that long. So if you're having a good movie, you want it to keep going. So I'm watching this, and I'm having the experience of this is a 24-hour fucking movie, and it's good, you know? And each dramatic moment leads to the next episode. So I'm flowing along, and I don't stop, and I get the whole season done in, you know, in 44 hours. It's 42-minute episodes, technically, without the commercials, so they're not hours. So 24 40s, whatever that is, that's what I technically did to watch, and I'd often rewind bits. And then I had to do other things. So it took 44 hours to do that. But it was incredible. What a great, great season. Really interesting.
Yeah.
And, so I'm going to, every few weeks, I'm going to set aside a 44, 45-hour slot and do the whole season.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah, it is.
Was that the last season you watched or the first?
Yeah, I know. I watched the last season as it unfolded this past year.
Okay.
I mean, last fall, whenever it started, I said, oh, this is last year. Hulu, you can see the older shows, they keep them up on this computer place, you know, and you just watch them. So you don't have to watch them live. I don't even have a TV, but I can see it all on my computer. So I caught up and watched the final 8th season. That's all I watched. I didn't know anything about the first 7 seasons. But Friday, I went back and watched the first season of 24 shows.
Yeah.
One of the main actors in it lived across the street from me in L.A.
Which actor? Not Kiefer Sutherland.
No, it's a, I don't know if she was the secretary. I never saw the show, but Mary Lynn Rajgrub or something.
Okay, I'll look it up. Yeah. I'll see which one she is. So the anyways, this is an advantage of not having to sleep as much. And I survived pretty good. I mean, I've never done that, really, not slept within, you know, a day. I don't go do that, do all-nighters. I don't have that kind of, I didn't have it as a student. I wasn't a student, so I didn't have to do all-nighters and all that. So I never, the only time I remember was staying up all night, basically, was the Zappa concert on April 25th, 1975 at Nassau Coliseum in Long Island. That was the night after I hung out with B4 and Zappa. That was a great night. And so it didn't end until 6 in the morning, so I just got on the subway and went back to my apartment in Manhattan, and I don't recall going to sleep that morning. It didn't happen.
What about the night you had Ken Kesey and Paul Krasner? Did you guys stay up all night?
Yeah, we eventually, it was dark, probably about 5 in the morning, we went to bed, and we woke up, you know, by 11 or something. And I remember it was waking me too early, and the reason we got woke up was the landlord came down. This was a loft for the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design on First and First in Manhattan. And we got woken up early because the landlord complained that Ken Kesey and Paul Krasner were in their apartment. They weren't registered students at the Nova Scotia Art College.
Oh, my God.
So, and two famous people in American culture, but the landlords were Canadians. I don't think they didn't know, they were artists, and they didn't know this world.
He's a Marxist artist, I believe.
Yeah, Marxist artist, Carl Beveridge. And
I think they just had a show recently, or his wife or something, a photo show at Dalhousie.
But I never looked that up. You can find that on the internet. If anything's up there, it goes there. Yeah, Carol, her name was Carol, and his name was Carl, and they were from Toronto. They were artists that believed in going, well, in the 70s, going into the factories and bringing culture to the workers. To the So they had a loft. It was maybe they owned most of the building, or I don't know what. It was 49 First and First, First Avenue interacting with First Street. And we stayed there many times.
That's where I met you, Bob.
That's where I met Greg in April 75. He came. He was a student of the Art College. He was visiting his friend out, relatives out in L.A. Your brother, I guess, right?
Yeah, I visited my brother and came over.
If you were a student at the Art College, you could stay there for free pretty well, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he walks in. He comes up the rough, weird elevator, big, huge elevator, and he comes in the afternoon. He comes in the loft, and what he witnesses is a guy dancing to some oldies station, the towel around him because he just got out of the shower. It was me, and he thought it was a whirling dervish. He said, "What the fuck is that guy?" So then we got talking, and you know, Greg can respond. He's a live guy, and so I ended up the next week or two. I went around, introduced him to Nam June Paik, John Cage. I showed him the whole. I introduced him to all the artists he was studying back in Halifax. It blew Greg's mind. He couldn't go back to school after that. He'd been there. He'd met them all. Why did he study them?
That was my graduation.
That was your graduation.
Yeah. That's great.
And that was April 25th. 75 is when I go to have an all-nighter with Zappa and Beefheart. So you showed. I know you were there for the Ken Kesey. You missed the Ken Kesey night, which was.
Yeah, I went to the talk, but I went off to visit Donnie that night.
That's right. So that was May 7th. You probably were there a week before, so you would have shown up just after I had the Zappa experience. And it was that week, the end of April, when Vietnam collapsed. You know, the famous scenes of America pulling out of the embassy.
Wow.
That was the last week of April 1975. So it was the end of the counterculture era, the 60s. Basically, after that, they didn't know what to protest against. All they had to do was drop in with McLuhan, then we could protest against, you know, mixed corporate media or the effects of the knitting of ignorance. The ignorance. We now protest the ignorance that implies oppression. Our whole mobile wheelie vehicle cyclometer. From the old one.
From the old one.
It's great. So Greg and I became friends and went back there, and we'd always hang out. And then I introduced him to you, Harry.
Yeah.
Probably about 1982.
Yeah, that's right. Right around then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Greg, you were probably there the day I taped Harry's class. You remember that?
Oh, I don't remember, no.
You know, Sue Bone was there. Like, I had this little tape recorder. It was a nice new modern one for that period. It was sitting there on the desk. Wow, Harry landed on about the old ones.
Clacking away in the blackboard.
Claiming it was an eyeball flipped upside down.
Right.
Right. It's, like, I always say to me, because I had this habit of going, right, I don't... He'll say something and go, right, Bob, right?
There we go.
Yeah. That's what Tom Wolfe said at the McLuhan, the first McLuhan conference. The award they gave him, the McLuhan lecture starting in February 99 that the Canadian Embassy put on every year for the last decade.
Yeah.
The first one was Tom Wolfe, and then the question period, I got up right away, and this was later broadcast on C-SPAN. They taped it because it was Tom Wolfe, the famous writer. So I said, I critiqued his whole nonsense, you know, and I said all this stuff very articulately, and he goes, well, there you have it.
You got it.
That's it. You got it. It's over. We can go home now. Get onto the art college grade. Why'd you bring that up?
I didn't.
Oh, there was something you were saying that brought that. Oh, just Zappa, right?
The
all night.
You're all night.
So I realized it was so easy to just get over that weird sensation at 5 and 6 in the morning, where you could go to sleep, or if you just ignore the buzz of it, you just go through, and then you're conscious again. You know, you get then you're normal. I realized that I could probably live 48 hours a day. I'd go through tonight and then sleep 24 hours later. In other words, have every other night not sleep.
Because,
you know, I do 3.5-4 hours, it seems. I just wake up and I'm relatively refreshed. So refreshed, I don't go back to sleep. So I missed my 3-hour segment the other night. So I woke up today, rare now, I slept for 6 hours.
Yeah.
So it gave me the extra 3 hours I missed the night before. I said, holy shit, I slept in. I've been asleep for 6 hours. I don't miss all my appointments.
You can't do that.
You can't do that, no. I'll have to get to bed every night to get my 3 hours in, because I'll fuck up if I take a night off. Otherwise, what's happening in Nova Scotia, Harry? Any reports on anybody? I guess all the people like Henry Hicks and all those people that played you at the university, they're all gone, right? There's nobody there.
That's right. A lot of them have dropped off.
Yeah? Is there anybody that you admire or respect or like that's still alive there?
Not that I know of.
Just yourself.
I just send you.
And
a couple of others, like Greg. And, there's just this, you know, I'm on an island. There's no doubt about the hell is John Dunn, you know.
Right, right.
I don't.
You have no problem with where he's just no man's island. No, I'm glad I'm an island, says he.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you ought to try my island, John, yeah. I spend a lot of time alone anyway. I've always had my lifetime has been a lonely one, if you want to put it that way.
No, it's solitude.
Solitude.
Not lonely,
right.
Solitude.
You're right. That's the correct correction.
Yeah, McLuhan said, he quoted Alvin Karp, one of those old 1920s Al Capone guys.
Yeah.
He asked him, what did he enjoy getting after he got in jail, after being in jail like for 50 years?
Yeah.
He says, I'm going to enjoy privacy.
Yeah.
Okay, so not loneliness,
right.
It's solitude. And McLuhan said, privacy is not solitude.
He
said today, privacy, people who are literate want privacy because they have an isolated sense of themselves caused by reading the book as a culture. By the electric age, we don't have privacy. We have solitude.
Yeah, yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. It's solitude.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a fragmented society. People can live by themselves, have their own TV, computers, and all this entertainment, womb to tomb stuff, right? It's all a little cocoon, and they don't need people.
That's right.
But they're lonely. They're just it's a society of solitudeness.
It's solitude, yeah.
And isn't that one of you taught that novel, 100 Years of Solitude?
Yeah, that's right. It's a great novel.
Yeah. There's a Brazilian guy, right, or something? Brazilian.
Yeah, Garcia Lopez, something I've forgotten.
Marquez.
Yeah. Thanks for reminding me, yeah.
Yeah, that book, I remember when it came out in the early 70s, some journalist pointed out that Dylan, he was in his comeback tour, was reading that book or saying it was a great book.
You know,
a person like Dylan, you probably even get it if you read his recent autobiography correctly. He's talking about people coming around hassling him, looking to meet him and all that. And that was a hassle.
Yeah.
But any famous person in that position gets into, they have to live a life of solitude because they can't go mingle with too many paparazzi around. So there's a solitudinous to the thing. And I was thinking back then, I bet you that's why he liked the book, the title, 100 Years of Solitude. It was right into what he was experiencing as a young star.
Yeah, sure. As a beginning artist,
Yeah, because most people are in prison. They're in work. They got to go to work every day and be forced to interact with people. They long for not solitude. They long for privacy.
Yeah, that's right, which isn't lonely.
And you get in the 24, it's incredible. They're in this super counterterrorism unit of surveillance, everything, and and they're all interacting, and there's factions right in the office. I mean, they're having wars against each other right in the office staff. It's like the gang wars of a prison.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, and so you want to get out of that involved, hyper-participatory, tribal fucking prison thing. And Bakunin used to take that and said the Greeks considered life a prison. So that was the trap.
Yeah, they did, that's right.
Was the trap of acoustic space. And then you bring in the alphabet. That freed the psyche up from the trap of acoustic space to go into the infinite realms of thought and imagination as laid out on the printed page or the manuscript page.
Yeah.
So now we're back into the electronic prison again. The acoustic space.
Try it again.
How do you get escape from that? Well, you get all this virtual technology and put yourself in a little hive or a little not a hive, a little matrix tube. And that's a dynamic for literate people. See, we're grow up literately. Our society, the streets are straight. It's going to kind of organized linearly. Literate effect makes it allows people, the Westerners, to get nuts over every new technology that Gates creates or Steve Jobs, because they're just putting this shield of virtual womb around them to retrieve the isolation you have or privacy you have when you read a book.
Yeah.
The digital form of literacy, all in response to the incredible incessant pressure of 24/7 news stuff telling you this and that. It's like 100,000 committees every day giving you press releases, telling you they discovered this or that. The problem with that psychic pressure, that's really shown in the series 24.
That would be interesting, really.
You guys can't get Netflix or Hulu, these American things, but you may have your Canadian version of it.
I think even YouTube, Bob, you could probably get it.
That's a good point. There might be some of this on...
Right.
If you find any, I'll send them to you, Harry. You can take a look at the way the show happens.
Okay. Sure. I'd like to see it, Bob.
Yeah, and this is 10 years old, because it started in the fall of 2001. I don't know if they thought of it before 9/11, but, it's pretty well, another few months, it'll be 10 years since they started.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. No, I'd like to see it if you think of it.
Yeah. So think of it in terms of Ulysses. You see, that's great to map it on the slower, leisurely pace of Bloom in Dublin compared to the digital, virtual fucking prison that people As a matter of fact, after yesterday's marathon, 24 hours, my joking response is, it's just people calling each other. Everybody's answering to their cell phone or calling someone and rapidly communicating messages as the panic unfolds, you know. It's just all telephone calls. And you wait, when you see it, you'll laugh. That's what it is.
It's a sure.
They're in this room with their computers, and all the time someone's phone's ringing. They're picking up phones. Okay, over there, do this. Okay, punk, and they hang up. Then they call someone. Okay, you do this, you go to punk, and then the other phone. That's all it is.
On a physical level, when I'm in L.A., wherever I am, I'm walking downtown, there's hardly any people.
Yeah.
When you get up in the airplane and you look down, they're on the highway. They're all going somewhere.
Yeah, that's why the joke in the 60s was if an alien came and looked at our cities, they'd think that the cars were the living organisms.
Yeah. it looked like
the bloodstream. Cars were driving around.
Yeah. Like a bloodstream at night.
Like a what?
Like a bloodstream at night.
Yeah. That's the first word. See, you read the first word of Finney's Wake, it says river run. You romantically put in the image of a little river. A Buddha's looking at the babbling, sitting by the babbling. Siddhartha has a vision by the babbling brook. No, it's the river running traffic that he saw outside his Paris apartment. And that's why that quote from 614 says autokinetic actively. It has kinetic, which is the automobile is the wheel, and the wheel is an extension of the kinetic sense, the feet in motion. So it's right there, autokinetically, whatever that word is, he says. He's talking, it's a way of verbalizing all the media, all the technological interactions of Paris in the 30s.
Yeah,
like the final apocalyptic last book on page 593 that goes to 628 and then merges back into page 3, the beginning of the book. It begins as calling on downs. It's a cop radio. It's like the intercom of cops calling somebody.
Yeah.
And then he says that calling on, maybe you could read it, Greg, the first couple lines. And then I think this is like low, like a Disney slow Tinkerbell fireworks, and then he's low, the chart was shown. Chaos, but it's like a UFO comes over the city and it's a big chart. Look at it. You got it there, 593?
593.
Yeah.
Oh, it's the start of book four, isn't it?
Yeah.
593. The start of the beginning?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Sandias.
Yeah, that's the Sanskrit Jose Hallelujah kind of thing. You know what
okay.
I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Calling all downs to Dane. Hooray, surrection, ire weaker to the wold of bluden world. O'Reilly. flank D, O'Reilly, to what lifelike tine of the bird can be. Seek you so many matters. Haze sea east to Oceania. Here, task, pat, staff, wolf, half, loaf, and rudder. The smog is lofting, and already the old man has gotten up on other times to litinate the Bonamores. Some fain avant. Gould modding, have used the piers ob. Fain yars agone. We have used yours up since we have fused now, Arthur. Calling all Danes to dawn. The old breeding Bradstead, Coleman Wolf of Nature's to Foyne McCooligan. The leader, Securus, Jubilant, Albus, Timorum. Cloggin, slogan. Quake up, dim dusky, doom for husky. And let Billy Fagan be ballad out of his humiliation, confidential to Churchin. We have highest gratifications in announcing to putter publicumst of practicing prater users, Genghis's goon for you. A hand from the cloud emerges, holding a chart, expanding.
There it is. You got that. So you have that preliminary, all this noise and chaos and things and beckonings are happening. It's like the trumpets doing their trumpeting before a big event, right?
Right.
And then it says what? The chart.
a hand from the cloud emerges.
In the Church of Genesis, that's the Stark fist of removal that comes out of the clouds. You know that drawing, Greg? This hand coming out, grabbing humans. That's called the Stark fist of removal. Well, that's like, except for mine has my chart on it.
Is that the Deus Machina, too?
What'd you say?
Is that the Deus Machina? That's
Machina is the... It's like, and then he woke up. It's a cop out, or all, here's this drama, no human can get him, and then all of a sudden the lightning bolt comes in and fixes it up, right?
Oh, okay.
Isn't that what it is?
Harry? Yeah, a god descends from wherever he descends from and solves the problem that exists with the characters on stage.
Yeah, so that's right. That chart is a Deus Ex Machina or machine.
Yeah,
it is.
Deus Ex Machina, yeah.
If you think it that way, it's just a big intervention happens.
Yeah.
Cosmic intervention.
And you've got the chart there, Bob.
Yeah, because that is about the intervention of Rai, the original separateness, returning to the plane of essence, and all the different ways you can interpret that.
Yeah.
And the chart is, I always say the chart is what Carolyn sees. She looks back and looks at, oh, what men tried to do. And she's sitting on the new ground of whatever she is, feminine, cosmic, some breakthrough from the patriarchal situation,
mm-hmm.
old form of medicine, and or healing and all that, and then she's looking back, and the chart is what she sees. That's all that came and went and failed. And that's actually going to happen pretty soon as a result of what we're doing with Ion. That's a heavy statement I'm making, which I can't go into detail. But you hear about it.
Yeah, one way or another.
Yeah, one way or another. You ain't going to escape this one.
That's right.
We call it Lockdown Bob Rule, but I was just the cover for Lockdown Connie Rule. I was a patsy, the Lee Harvey Oswald, ran the red herring for 40 years.
Oh, boy.
You know, there's a site called Farm. Have you looked at Information Farm, Greg?
Once, yeah. Somebody sent me something with that.
Yeah, it's a great site, and he has this... He's got more interest in Ion. He plants.
Oh yeah, that's why I was there. I've got that bookmarked. Yeah.
Yeah, he presents all kinds of fringe interviews. It's an incredible flood of information. But he started listening to Ion on the radio, and he was pretty impressed. So he's sort of subliminally putting Ion in, and now it's gotten so blatant. He has his headline, his front page, his farm vertical, and then information horizontal. But it has the ION of information blooming out larger in a different color, so it's in from that ION.
Yeah, very good.
Yep. So, Harry, I carried on your work, and I hope you're glad of what I did with it, and proud that it kept going.
Yeah, I sure am.
It's Worcester says, thrill, thrill. I did that in there when you said, I sure am, Bob.
There we are.
Yeah, when Jesus came back, or if he ever did, St. Peter and all the guys, look at this church we built. Look, we made this whole fucking religion. Went for 2,000 years. And so we look at it and go, yeah, thrill, thrill.
What a big deal.
I apologize. You guys were fucking wrong. I should have told you that I was bullshitting. I made it all up, for fuck's sake, and you guys made it come true.
You heard everything I didn't say.
Yeah, that's very good. Let me repeat what I was about to say.
Hey, Bob. Bob, it's Carolyn.
Oh, here's Carolyn here.
You guys, it sounds like you guys are creating a laugh track.
Yeah.
Is that what this is all about?
Yeah, we got a sip and bump each if we get some laughing for 2 hours.
But we have to talk ourselves into it with our own speculations, at least the humor, and then we get some laughs that we can edit out.
It'll happen more often, Bob.
Yes, yeah. So you know who I'm talking to, Karen?
No.
This is Harry Whittier.
Oh, my gosh.
Hi, Karen.
Hi, Harry. Good to hear your voice and your laughter.
Oh, thank you.
Wonderful. Oh, that's great, Bob. Okay, don't let me interrupt. I'll just listen in the background.
Yeah, well, Carolyn, if you can contribute, we'd appreciate it. It's all about you, so...
It just led up to you, and then you appeared.
Oh.
Yeah, Because Judy Kellen just came home about, what, 20 minutes ago?
Right.
She was just walking in, and it's actually happening in her, what's called the master bedroom that looks out over the bay on the side of a mountain. But, you know, if you just sleep in this room, you know, you're not even aware of it. Just use it when you're sleeping. So Kellen took the master bedroom and made it her office, and we sleep in the back. So the computer and phone is in her office. That's what she walked into when she came home 20 minutes ago. So she just had this old crotchety voice, mine, and these young voices like Harry and Greg.
Oh, and Greg's there. Oh, hi, Greg.
Hi, Carol. Yeah, Greg's there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I called up Greg, and he told me he had visited Harry the other day, and I said, well, I've been meaning to talk to Harry the past 6 months to see if he had inherent advice, so I said, let me call him. So I kept Greg on the line and just called up Harry, and he was there.
Perfect.
Yeah. We've had a great not a reunion, feed forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Forward.
Very good.
Yeah, it's been really interesting stuff, Carol, on there.
Good.
We went into the eyeball turning upside down.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what's that illustration in by Odilon Redon? You know, the big eyeball? Is that anything to do with anything?
You mean the Illuminati thing?
No, maybe that's what they use, but you know, it's like a balloon, but it's an eyeball. It's a drawing by the French painter, Odilon, the symbolist.
Oh, okay, yeah, that sounds familiar. Well, but you, this is a side view of the eyeball.
Ah, okay.
You know, right, you know, you showed the reflecting, the Newtonian optics going into the eyeball.
Right,
that's right.
Yeah.
Not the round thing, you show the eyelids to the side.
And that's right in Harry's formula on the board, too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you could maybe see that in the drawing on page 293 of Finnegan's Wake, because it's two circles overlapping.
That's right.
It could be two eyes becoming cross-eyed. You know, they're sort of merging. If you jokingly showed someone's eyeballs coming together as they get, you know, in a joke sense, cross-eyed, that's what seems to be going on that... Joyce knows that you are going to go cross-eyed trying to read the book.
Right.
Yeah. If you you take a careful look at those two circles that are interlocking slightly, you'll notice that what that interlocking forms is a lens.
That's right. That's it. Now that and so that is it does that, include Newtonian optics in there.
Yeah, sure it does.
It's multi-level, but that's suggested. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because some people see it as the Hestia Vices or whatever archetypal ancient symbol or something.
Yeah, that's right. But it's
different. Geometry.
Yeah, it's geometric optic.
Yeah, Hestia Vices or something, or visceral Pisces.
That's right.
Phrase.
And
then you can look at it as two buttocks, or, you know, two... And then there's the vagina. It's a great image. It has, say it's more comprehensive than the Newtonian one you use on your chart. The optic one that you use on your blackboard, Harry, you're pointing to more comprehensive meanings, but that comprehensive meaning, multi-levelness, is shown in page 93 of Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah. I didn't know that, but
the lens in there, it's applied.
Well, the lens also is what turns things upside down.
The
mirror turns them left and right or reversed, and the lens turns them upside down.
Yeah, McLuhan in Cliché-Archetype writes about how the mirror is appropriate if you use the mirror as a symbol for the mind, because the mirror can mean the recycling of all experience.
And
that's the mind.
Right, that's the mind, and that is what else is there, is what you find with this lens.
Yes, I think that McLuhan was thinking of the image in Finnegan's Wake when he wrote that, Cliché Archetype.
Yeah.
An image of the mirroring process, of the mind process, of two people interacting. It's actually summing up what we've been talking about. What I brought in is the interaction of two people where mingling of cognition, and they kind of think they're in the same space, but they're... involved in the mechanics of the flipping too, which means they don't operate the same space.
Yeah, that's right.
So
that's
it's
very complex thing.
And I see that it's an expression of what McLuhan meant by the tactile interplay. The tactile gap. That's what should be operated on in that thing. You wouldn't just say it's a vagina or this or that. It is showing the process of cognition between the two conversations.
Yeah, that's right. It's important to recognize that.
Yeah.
Because people turn it into information or objects and the rest of it, and you lose it, you know.
They make it one conversation or the other, and then they argue over which one it is.
Yeah, that's right. It's like a debate in Parliament gets nowhere.
Yes. It's like most of the Gutenberg galaxy, what's happened in our society since the printing press. Ion goes on about the printing press with the Dark Ages.
Yeah.
And he goes in and describes the effects of that and how the whole concept of time got solidified, and Ion says, the first fucking thing you want to know is there's no time.
Yeah.
He says there's only timing.
Timing, yes.
Yes, said Harry, the new cult devotee. Yes, Bob, yes.
I don't believe a word you're saying, Bob. I'm just being pleasant.
You're being static, which I know. The conversation with Bob is static commuted. I haven't been with my book.
After all, I'm a Nova Scotian.
Yes. Right. Harry, did I ever tell you my theory about why Maritimers in Canada speak with they go aboot? It's aboot.
Aboot.
Yeah, because I once, many years ago, saw some footage on some news of a hella, you know, Nova Scotian fisherman, and he was talking in a real tight mouth.
Yeah.
And it was probably windy and all that. And I thought, oh, yeah, as you go further south to Georgia, the warmth of the air loosens up your jaw muscles, so you don't go aboot, you go about. You go your mouth muscles. And that's why we go aboot, or Canadians go aboot, with too cold, you know, you don't open your mouth very much.
Very good.
I think we cracked that one.
That's done.
I noticed when I go south that the sound seems to be clearer or more intensified. I don't know whether it's...
More eloquent? You mean more hearable? More articulate?
Yeah, more articulate, more pleasurable.
The speech patterns, you mean?
No, the sound of music, for instance. But even all sounds, you know, I think... Here we have wooden buildings. Down there, there's like, you know, stucco, and it's drier, and I think things just bounce around more down there.
Yeah, or bounce differently and more pleasantly. Or it could be it's different to you because you're used to the timber of Nova Scotia, and so it's pleasurable to go to another kind of sound.
Yeah, it could be the other side of the mountain.
Yeah, they might think they like going north, but the point is they are different. It's a different environment. We'll make different acoustics.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that's right. It'll be different acoustics.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're in the south, you're in a warmth, a womb of warmth, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You almost say in the Maritimes, you're abruptly interacting with bouncing off things, bumping into things, because they're cold and hard.
Mm. Different every day.
So did you read any of these pension books again lately, Harry?
No. I've been I read Against the Day again.
Ah, okay. So what would you say about it? What strikes you?
Oh boy, it's too big to start now, Bob.
Right, but I mean, is there any particular scene or not style, but content that stands out in your memory?
The one that struck me most, I think, this is right at the top of my head. I probably changed my mind four times before I get finished.
Yeah.
But there's a long passage in which the vehicle that they're traveling in travels under the sand. Do you remember? It's on the edge of the Gobi Desert.
Okay, no, I haven't read the book, so it's too long.
Oh,
I haven't had the time to do it. But anyways, you go under the sand in the desert.
Yeah. They develop machinery that will allow a metallic vessel, like a submarine, to travel under the sand in the same way that a submarine would go underwater. And it's on an adventuresome trip. And that stuck with me. I waited until I got to it when I was reading it a third time, which was this last time.
So that you've read the book three times, and that's most people haven't got the time or can pay to do that. That's pretty heroic in the reading world to read Pynchon three times, the same book.
Oh, yeah. No, you know Pynchon well enough to know that it's easy, you know.
Well, it's luxurious. Once you get reading, it's so delectable. And so he probably described the way the sand fell away or something, like the minor detail.
Yeah, that kind of detail is great. It's striking.
And you can get that kind of detail on dope or marijuana or LSD. I keep thinking that he gets stoned and he just describes the slowing down of, quote, time.
Of everything,
And he may get stoned a lot when he writes this. Because apparently he used marijuana a lot in the early days.
In the early days, I don't know about...
Maybe you would develop ability to do it without the drugs, you know.
Yeah.
But it's almost like a meditative or slowed down state, right?
Yes, that's right. Everything slows down.
And he describes the subtle shifts of every little moment.
Yeah, every grain of sand almost, that's off the top of my head, Bob.
Well, that's all I want to know. I like talking about Pynchon, so I'm ready to go to the beach.
Yeah. Don't try the understand trick at first.
Do what?
Don't try the understand trick first.
Understand.
Try to punch the sand against the day.
Right. Don't try it. No, I do it in the water. Going into the waves is my form of immersion.
Yeah, mine too. I miss that.
Yeah, it's incredible to walk, the beautiful walk, and I'll send you the link of 150 pictures that shows the walk we do every day. It's all I experience now. I don't go into, we don't have a car, so I don't go into the little town and see traffic lights or something. I live in this Garden of Eden. I walk this path. At the end of my walk, I swim in the water and the waves for half an hour and then come back home and then shower. But it's so great at the end of the walk to have a beach to drop into, you know.
Beautiful.
Rather than going out at the end of Point Pleasant Park and Halifax, look at the fucking harbor, it's too cold, and a bunch of idiots are walking around, and then you walk back home, you know.
You've got it.
As a matter of fact, there's a curious mirror effect here. We used to live in Dartmouth looking over the harbor. We're doing that here, looking over the harbor and the bay, The address is 52. It's the opposite of 20. In Nova Scotia, it was 25.
Yeah.
We're at 52, and it's the exact... Halifax Dartmouth was a great, geographically or scenery-wise, a neat place, you know, lakes and all that.
And
we have that paradisical northern vista. Now I have it here in the southern vista.
Right.
And to cap off that I felt like I was in a mirror world is that one day the house next to it, they only come every Christmas or so. They own the house, but they live in Chicago, so they're not here often.
Jeez.
And so that's good. So we have the no house next to us, so it's not occupied. But every now and then they come for a holiday. And they came one day, and the next day I looked out, and the two boys, young boys, were playing ball hockey, which is the common thing you see in Halifax. You know, people running around.
Yeah, sure.
One of the big things. And so I thought, well, this proves I'm in a mirror world of Nova Scotia, of Dartmouth, because the one common scene that I always saw in Dartmouth was kids playing ball hockey. And here in Hawaii, so I met the guy, the father, got talking to him, and he kind of apologized and said, well, we're a hockey family. You know, the kids play all these leagues. So I don't think any Hawaiian plays ball hockey. You know, you can't see that here. In Hawaii, I don't think you see any hockey, so it's not what kids do. But right beside me, the one house has the ball hockey, so it was there for me to complete my idea that I was in the mirror Dartmouth.
Yeah, that's great. There's the equivalent in Hawaii that I remember is just Oahu. When I was in the Navy, we were out there for a while. Just sort of an over-civilized, semi-tropical city, you know.
Meet Honolulu.
Honolulu and neighboring, you know, Pearl Harbor, the naval base.
Were you there in 49?
Yeah, it was 48, 49, around there.
Yeah, that's what Dave Worster, the channel for Cosmic Awareness, was.
Oh, yeah.
Now, he was born in 1928. When were you born?
24.
Oh, 24. So, but then that doesn't matter. There's a range of age that you would be in the Navy anyways, right? So he was there, and he was like 21, 22, and the Navy had a little radio broadcasting, and he knew records or something, so he got on there and had his little slot, and he was called the Magic Blue Boy, and the Hawaiian, what do they call it, Kahuna priest, they were listening to him, and they thought he was a cool guy, so they invited him into their Kahuna religion. They initiated him.
Oh.
And then he became a mystic later for cosmic awareness, so to speak. But that was what he was. He was the Magic Blue Boy on the the Navy radio station.
That's fantastic.
The same time as you were. You may have heard him.
I could have very easily. Yeah.
Harry, tell Bob about, I know it's not a big thing, but when you went to find your ship, but you couldn't find it, what was that all about?
Yeah, well, that was the end of the Second World War. Yeah. It took me 3 months to find it.
What were you looking for?
My first ship. I graduated from the Naval Academy in 45, in June of 45, and went out to San Francisco in October, and from then on, for 3 months, I went across the Pacific 3 times as a courier. They used you as a courier in those days.
You went to Japan?
No. I went to from San Francisco to Pearl Harbor, and from Pearl Harbor to Johns Land and Kwajalein, Guam, Saipan, Iwo Jima, finally, and that's where I picked the ship up 3 months later. That's what it was. The grand strategy, this was before the atomic bomb was dropped, was the two pincer movements, one around by the Aleutians and the other. And, of course, they dropped the bomb, and that the grand strategy became Coast Guards.
Right.
So now
you're saying that you lost, when you couldn't find something? What did you say?
Yeah, well, when the war ended, blew everybody's mind. They all said to hell with everything, and the things got very confused. So they lost, for some reason, the receiving ships that I went to, and that's the offices where the ships are mapped and where they are and the rest of it. The ones that I happened to go to didn't know where the ship was. So I couldn't, they didn't know what the hell to do with me, so they sent me off somewhere and said, have a nice time, It was ridiculous. And the conclusion of all this was that their ship was anchored off the main beach at Iwo Jima. And I went up to introduce myself to the captain. He says, where the hell have you been? And I said, and I said, oh, I've been, how are you fixed for time, Captain? That's what,
that's October. It took you 3 months to find what the ships were assigned to.
Yeah, October, November, December. Yeah, it was in December.
Right. So what, you were able just to lay around and do what you wanted in the period of looking for it?
Yeah, well, you stay in a receiving ship, so-called, and they have the officer's mess and all that crap.
Right.
And you go to the office every morning and say, have you got any news on where the Columbus is? And they didn't know, and so forth. and again and again and again. And so you just spend your time either walking up and down the main streets of Honolulu wondering what the hell you're going to do next, or as if you didn't know, and let it go at that. And it wasn't at the end of 2.5 months of this, you get very tired of it.
Yeah, and then it was right there, obvious, in Iwo Jima.
Yeah, it was there, yeah. I walked on the beach, and they made that incredible landing on. It was black volcanic ash.
Yeah.
You walk on it, and you sink to your knees, How the hell they ever walked up the beach, I don't know.
Pretty neat. Well, that's an appropriate image to end this on. You're talking about the neighborhood. Very good.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, they're not on Iwo Jima, but...
Yeah, but it's in the, you know, it's Hawaiian beach. It's a general bay category of beach.
You could go under the sand if you're in Iwo Jima.
Yeah, that's inspiration.
Yeah, that's right. That would have been a place he tried it out.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's been really good talking to Harry. I'll be calling you again soon, and...
Yeah, I do, Bob. It's really good to hear your voice. Good to talk to you again, too.
Good night, Harry.
Yeah, thank you.
Good night.
Thanks, Harry. Bye, Greg.
Bye, Carolyn.
Bye,
Bob.
Bye, Harry. Bye, Greg. Great
show. Enjoy the water.
Show will be back next week.
Keep laughing.
Okay, see you later.